This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A hit from Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass from the 1960s. Maybe you had this album in your collection. Yes, it's the one with the whipped cream on the cover. This hour, we look at what's behind the revival of vinyl albums and other trends in the music industry, including the fact that more and more users are listening from large online libraries of music, like Rhapsody, Spotify, or Pandora, rather than purchasing individual songs or albums. Trends in the music industry this hour, right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we explore trends in the music industry. It's part of Public Radio Music Month. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll visit with Bob Harrington. He's the owner of Ragged Records in Davenport. He'll tell us about the real uptick in vinyl sales. Yes, vinyl album sales that he's seen in recent years. It's an uptick that matches the national trend for vinyl records. And so we want this hour to have you tell us, answer this question: what's your favorite vinyl album of all time? And send it to us via Facebook, a post there, or tweet us, IPR Talk, or email us, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. Now, maybe you're saying, I have 5 or 10 favorite vinyl albums. Here's the Rorschach inkblot method of getting down to one. Close your eyes. Picture a vinyl album cover. The first one you see is the one that you post to our Facebook page, or you tweet us at IPR Talk, or you email us, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. Joining me, first of all, Tom Carolyn is back with us, and he attended the University of Iowa in the 1980s, and in his early career, he was an executive at Atlantic Records, responsible for signing many well-known artists. More recently, the founder and president of something called Total Live Music, a service provider to live entertainment as well as an online destination for live music database. And more recently than that, founder of Total Music Box, a design and manufacturing company focusing on limited edition collectible packages for recording artists. Tom Carolyn, welcome back to our program.
Thank you for inviting me, Ben.
It's been several years, 2009 when I look back at my notes, since you were on our show. A lot has changed in this very quickly changing music scene. Global recorded music sales in 2012 increased for the first time since 1999 last year, only 0.3% to $16.5 billion. That's according to a report by the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry. Tom, give us your overview of the significant trends you are seeing in the music industry today.
Well, sure, and I think that is a positive sign. I think we've seen stabilization. Obviously, the internet has caused great access for the consumer and a lot of disruption towards the business side of it. That being said, it's taken a little while to right the ship because the consumer has kind of led the way, and on the internet in regards to access. I think we saw it first with Napster and the business side constantly trying to fight it, the iTunes model coming in, offering somewhat of a savior to it, but with still the piracy models conflicting, it's offsetting the sales. And now I think we're starting to see where both the consumer and the business side, I'm talking about the record companies now, finally reaching a point where they understand how the consumer wants to receive their music, and the record label's adapting to that thing. So it's really, it's been an exciting time, but it's also been an evolving time, as you said.
Mm-hmm. So give us the best. It's taken years. You said disruption for the business side because the consumers have been driving this. We hear again and again that it's democratized music and the music industry. And I assume that's what you mean by consumer-driven changes in part. So what can you tell us, profile the way people are listening now?
Sure.
What have we learned?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it's very simple. I mean, I think the biggest argument going on right now is streaming versus the download model. And I think as from a consumer standpoint, we're seeing more gravitation over to the streaming model, meaning you have certain companies out there such as Spotify and radio that offer a subscription service to the, quite frankly, the entire library of the world of music at your fingertips. So ownership, everybody, the consumer is starting to move away from the ownership model. And it's really about points of access, whether it be via their computer, their smartphone, and through these streaming services, they have access to a library they never did before.
Mm-hmm. It's much larger than anyone has ever had. And you know what, Tom? You don't have to dust it.
That's correct. And the record labels traditionally like to create control and scarcity into the marketplace. That way they were able to drive the price points of CD sales and actually have that control and create huge margins for themselves. And now it's just not there anymore for them.
So what does the picture look like for the record labels?
Well, I think they've turned over their model more from controlling the manufacturing distribution points of it, which is what we're really talking about, the internet, to more of an intellectual property rights ownership of it. So basically they feel their strongest game points right now is going to be the marketing and promotion of a particular talent, increase the value of the intellectual property rights, and then from there try to acquire as many revenue streams as they possibly can.
Okay, and who's doing this well in the industry right now?
Well, it's hard to say because, nobody's doing as well as they want to be doing. But I think what we're starting to see is, the independent labels as well as the major labels is what we're trying to find out is the stabilization. Who's really doing it well are the artists themselves.
Okay, well before talking about the musician side of it, we only have about 5 minutes left.
Sure.
Tell us about Twitter. Twitter just went live with a new music service connecting listeners with websites where they can purchase music they enjoy.
Right.
What's your read on that?
Well, I think where everybody's trying to run to right now is what the one thing missing in today's internet and what Twitter's trying to grab hold of, and we're going to see a new music company called Daisy, which is a collaboration between Mog, Topspin, and Universal Music Group, is the discovery process. I think the internet has been great in regards to the offerings, but there's been no discovery. And what Twitter's trying to do, along with a number of these other services, is try to base new discoveries for a fan based on their interests and likes. And they're trying to use that based on data and information that they're receiving.
So get them out of the rut and get them listening to the good old ones they've always liked, but then channel them into new things being produced.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So let's do talk quickly about the musicians, what this is meaning for the musicians. How has that scene developed for them in the past few years?
Well, what's good about it happening for the musicians is they now have more access to have a relationship with their fans. And, where it used to be initially when the internet first was produced, they build a website. And then all these social marketing tools came along, and there's more consumer rights management, as they call it, where they're interacting more directly with their fans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that changes the way music is marketed.
Yes, correct.
In what way? So what would a clever young musician have his fingers in right now in terms of marketing his band or his music?
Sure. Well, traditionally where they used to sit there and put the initial value into the recording of the music, a number of these young artists are posting their music basically for free. And it's just really about trying to establish a fan base, get an interaction going online, build momentum online, acquire a conversation with those fans, and then once you have those fan base inside your conversation, try to create revenue streams with it through your merchandise and other things.
Radio is dying. We hear that as a common belief out there in terms of music. Where are we there in terms of not only regular terrestrial radio, but online streaming radio stations?
Well, we've heard about the death of the music business, for a long, long time, and I don't think anything's really set dying as much as it has to evolve. Radio, I still think there's a certain element that's going to be where people are going to want to have their music formatted for them. And that's the advantage of radio, whether it be, you know, certain niche shows, or I don't think, you know, maybe top 40 radio and generalized radio state music radio stations may be hurting as of right now. But I think once we move into more niche identifying type of shows, I still think people are going to want their music formatted for them.
Tom, you are founder and president of Total Live Music, Total Box Music as well. I know you deal with live music, or that concerns you. Is this the one staple in this really quick evolution of music lovers that will never change? Or has this changed the live music landscape as well?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's still a demand out there. I mean, the demand, you can't stop the demand for the live performance. The problem that I think of experience is that the major labels were the ones that used to spend all the money marketing, promoting, and could get artists to a certain level faster than the internet has proven itself to be, meaning that with the right proper dollars in marketing, an artist could go from playing a 500-seat club to a 1,000-seat general admissions arena or whatever faster than what we're seeing that the internet is able to do. It's a slower build. So in live music, there's really a few major players like Live Nation and AEG whose venues, you know, they have these five. They just announced this week that Universal out here in California, the Universal Amphitheater is closing, the Gibson Amphitheater, a 5,000-seat venue, because they just don't have the amount of talent to keep the doors open.
Mm-hmm. If you're an artist or a band, where are you making your music mostly, or how does that split, that revenue pie? Are you making it from your live music, your gigs, or from your sold product?
You're basically making it tickets and merchandise.
Tickets and merchandise. That means more than just music. That means what, T-shirts?
Yeah, T-shirts, anything. Like, for instance, what we focus on is we focus on the Total Box Music, is we focus on delivering high-end merchandise of collectibles around an individual's music. And we sell pieces for Trent Reznor to No Doubt to 30 Seconds to Mars, to where we're actually creating vinyl collectible photo books, signed lithos by the performers, and selling them for $300 to the hardcore fans. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as an individual new young artist is concerned, the real value of the recorded music now is more of a marketing tool and to try to drive people to their live shows.
Very quickly, we have less than a minute left. Piracy slowing down, yet wasn't there a study that said piracy not harming music industry revenues?
Well, I think that study could be quite correct, because I think piracy, if you dig back, are for real hardcore people that are, you know, not necessarily driven towards, you know, stealing from the original matter anyway. So piracy is a difficult thing to judge.
Okay. Any quick word as to what we should see on the horizon as something we might not have heard about yet that you can see with your perspective?
I just think that right now the big debate is discovery and streaming versus download. I think we're going to see more of a tendency going through streaming, and you're going to see a number of companies trying to offer discovery services.
Tom Carolyn, thank you for joining us again, founder and president of Total Live Music and Total Box Music. How can we find you on the web, Tom?
Just go to totalboxmusic.com, and you'll see my website and our offerings.
Okay, Tom, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Now, let's spend a moment on the vinyl revival in the music industry. This album from 1969, Abbey Road, and we're listening to Come Together off that album, was the second best-selling album on vinyl last year in 2012. Now, in just a moment, we'll reveal the number one selling vinyl record last year. Here's a hint, it's not from the 60s, not from the 70s, not from the 80s, not even from the 90s. You'll have to wait to find out what that number one selling vinyl album was from 2012. In 2012, it was another great year for vinyl album sales. The U.S. saw its fifth year of record-breaking sales. Now, We have to remember, vinyl sales remain a tiny percentage of overall album sales, but represent a steadily growing niche, feeding audiophiles and collectors. According to the Nielsen Company, in 2012, vinyl album sales reached 4.6 million in sales, breaking the previous record of 3.9 million LP album sales in 2011. Here's an important point. 67% of all vinyl albums were purchased at an independent music store during last year. Joining us now to talk about the vinyl revival, among other things, Bob Harrington. He is the owner of Ragged Records in Davenport. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you.
You, I understand, have worked or owned record stores for the past 30 years.
Yes, I started in the early mid-80s working for an independent chain based out of the Quad Cities, and went on from that to own a few of those stores and eventually sell those. And now I've, for the past 5-6 years, I've had another store in Davenport.
Mm-hmm. So give us a little bit of a sense of the ebb and flow of vinyl. Of course, CDs and cassettes, CDs mostly, come along to make vinyl less popular, and then it comes back. How did that happen? When did it happen?
Well, you know, it's the labels did a very good job of telling people that vinyl was not as good sounding as CDs. Actually, it's just a different sound. And that happened in the early 90s. And then with in the late 90s, early 2000s, as people started doing digital downloads, then, you know, music sales waned as far as on CDs. So I think the labels were looking at, you know, another format that they could put out again to, you know, a hard copy of something that somebody could buy as opposed to just downloading.
Mm-hmm. And now very often you'll see artists, even local Iowa artists all around the country, it's not unusual to have them release a new album on vinyl, and then you get a free digital download with the purchase of the vinyl, right?
Yeah, it seems in most cases that there's a digital download anymore. And sometimes there's a hard CD copy that comes inside records as well.
Mm-hmm. So what is the allure of the vinyl, the analog sound? I suppose it's hard to describe. You just have to hear it, or can you describe the difference between digital and...
It's kind of a personal preference, I think. You know, a lot of people, I find that a CD is more sterile and colder sound, and then there's much more warmth to a record.
Mm-hmm. Now, in just a moment, we're going to hear the top-selling vinyl album of last year, and I think it'll be a surprise for people. But tell us, do you see on vinyl what sorts of artists, what genres of music are more popular on vinyl than others?
You know, up until the past year, it seemed to be more of indie artists, you know, punk rock and, you know, alternative music, alt country, things like that, you know, indie-type bands. Now I've noticed in this year that we're starting to see, even with the Record Store Day that just happened 2 Saturdays ago, you know, an artist like Eric Church, who's a big-selling country artist who normally doesn't sell maybe in an independent store, you know, has a vinyl release out for Record Store Day and actually was one of the most requested ones that we had.
Mm. So you're really seeing an uptick in vinyl?
Oh, most definitely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Record Store Day. That was April 20th. What is that day about and what happened?
On April 20th, well, it's the third Saturday every year, the record labels put out limited edition vinyl, and they can be anywhere from, you know, maybe 200 copies, you know, across the country to maybe 5,000 copies, with the average being around 1,000 or 2,000 copies. And they come out for one day, they're available for one day, and, you know, it's a big event where collectors, you know, come out, they get in line and want to get that limited edition thing. You know, your store maybe was only able to obtain 2 or 3 copies of something, you know, and you may have 30 people in line that all want that same record. So it's you know, it's a pretty big event.
So it's kind of like a fine wine or a fine cheese event, if I can put it in those.
Absolutely.
and the record stores, such as yours, are not about, you're not in the, oh, you can conveniently download this anymore. It's about an experience.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. What's the experience
of going to a record store? I mean, a lot of younger people, I actually have younger people that come in with their parents who have no idea what records are. So that's pretty amazing. I mean, you hear stuff like that, but when it actually, you know, some kids like, I've never seen one of these before, that's, you know, pretty unusual.
Wow. So you have the kids with their parents picking up an album, looking at this big space for artwork that we used to all enjoy, and the kids are blown away, huh?
Oh, absolutely. And it's kind of cool, too, you know, that Dad will come in and buy, you know, a Foreigner record, and his son will buy, you know, the new Mumford & Sons. So it's kind of fun that they're out, you know, shopping together for for music.
So let me ask you about the future of a couple formats. We know digital downloading is big. What happens to CDs from here on out? I know they had a big, over 15% drop in sales last year.
Yeah, I mean, I see CDs waning. Since I do sell used CDs in stock, you know, close to probably 15,000 at any given time. And I've noticed many things as I check to put things out that are out of print now, that are no longer available new. And so CDs are actually becoming collectible, I mean, which has surprised me. A few years ago, you know, used CDs were all pretty much the same price. And now there's starting to be things that are harder to find, and those are becoming collectible.
So we might see the same sort of thing happen with CDs, or beginning to happen with them, that we saw happen with vinyl a few years ago.
I think so. I think, you know, the people that were buying CDs in the 80s and 90s, now that will become a nostalgic thing for them, you know, down the road. So, you know, possibly CDs will become more collectible.
And then finally, today, Bob, the future of vinyl as you see it, 5 or 10 years down the road?
You know, I see it sticking around for a while. I mean, there's a really good interest with younger people, and I think the labels like having something out, you know, that they can sell as a hard copy, even if it's not something that's going to sell in huge quantity, you know, like million sellers on CD were. But I see it being, you know, a niche market. I think there will be, you know, some sort of market for that in the future.
So Bob, when you look at the sale of vinyl at your store, Ragged Records, in Davenport, point to some things that you think are unusual on vinyl, things that we might not connect with vinyl.
Sure. Like I said earlier, you know, we're selling Eric Church has become pretty popular on vinyl with Record Store Day. But things that younger people are buying, and when I say younger people, I'm not talking, you know, 20-something, I'm talking teenagers like Taylor Swift and, you know, items like that that are, you know, geared toward a much younger audience.
Mm-hmm. And these kids have turntables at home.
A lot of them do, and we actually sell vintage stereo equipment, so I sell a lot of used turntables to people. I've actually sold lots of records to people who didn't realize that they didn't even have a turntable. They were just buying records and then ended up buying a turntable from me, you know, later on.
And finally, Bob, I remember this when vinyl was really on its way out, that there were lots of people who were setting their old vinyl out in the sun on a hot summer day, to melt and turn into ashtrays and other bowl-like things. Is that sacrilege now?
For me, it's always been sacrilege.
Have you ever...
If you set your records out on the street corner and I was driving by, I probably would have picked them up. I've always picked up, you know, and bought used record collections. So.
Okay, Bob Harrington, thank you for sharing some time with us and some insights. Owner of Ragged Records in Davenport, Bob has worked or owned record stores for 30 years. Bob, you take care. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, we continue our survey of changes in the music industry. It's Public Radio Music Month. Documentary producer and UI faculty member Kembru McLeod. Also, Sean Moeller, the founder of Daytrotter. Before the break, though, as promised, a sample of the number one selling vinyl album from last year, from 2012. This is from the album Blunderbuss by Jack White. It's a cut called Missing Pieces. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
I was in the shower, so I could not tell my nose was bleeding. Dripped down my body to the floor, right below my feet. Looked in the mirror of my face, I thought I had a disease. Yeah. And there's a woman with her fingers in my icebox. She peeped around the corner, asked me if I'm okay. She put the ice up on my tongue, and then it melted away.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, exploring trends in the music industry. It's part of Public Radio Music Month. And in our first half hour, I reached out to you, our listeners, to tell us your picture, actually, your favorite vinyl album cover of all time. Got a lot of response to that. A tweet from Josh. Godspeed You, Black Emperor. The album Lift Your Skinny Fists Like Antennas to Heaven. Good Old Boys by Randy Newman, the album named by Chris. CJ, he says he thinks instantly of his first Rat-a-Tat self-titled album. An email from Mark in Des Moines. Elton John, Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy. Excellent artwork and even better music. Mark in Des Moines, I agree completely with you. A tweet from Mason, Pink Floyd's The Wall, that legendary cover, he says, a legendary album, legendary band. Everybody had a copy, and it sounds best on vinyl, tweeting Mason. Eric tweets Neil Young's album, Decade. Jack in Cedar Falls, Kinda Blue, Miles Davis, and our old colleague, our beloved colleague, Jeff Schmidt in Illinois. He wants to throw out Bob Dylan, Blonde on Blonde. Here's one from Kyle, a Facebook post, Snoopy's Merry Christmas. It's a sentimental childhood favorite. Nothing rings in the season like war-themed tunes complete with the sound effects of Red Baron dogfights. Okay, thank you. What's your favorite vinyl album cover of all time? Your favorite album on vinyl? Facebook post would do it for us, or tweet us IPR Talk, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. My guests this half hour, Kembru McLeod is in our Iowa City studio, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa, an independent documentary producer. In fact, he's written and produced several books and documentaries that focus on popular music, independent media, copyright law. His music and cultural criticism have appeared in many places, including Rolling Stone, Spin, Mojo, The New York Times, Los Angeles Times. Kembru McLeod, welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
Sean Moeller on the phone with us, the founder of Daytrotter.com in the Quad Cities. Daytrotter.com, for those of you who don't know, a website for a recording studio that's located, I believe, still in Rock Island. It hosts recording sessions with many popular and upcoming indie music acts. Sean Moeller, welcome back to our program.
Hey, thanks, Ben.
Hey, let's go to Kembru, to you first of all, and let me throw out this big net and ask you, what are the most interesting music developments and trends from your perspective?
Well, I mean, I think the most obvious is in the past 10 years is how digital distribution, you know, whether we're talking about downloading MP3s legally or illegally, or streaming radio like Pandora or Spotify, those sorts of services, that's radically reconfigured the way people consume music and can find music on top of that. Like, it, in many ways, it makes it much easier to find or to discover new kinds of music that you like. Pandora is one example, but there are lots of other ways in which that can happen. And what's happened, what accompanied the shift is obviously falling record, or I should say CD sales, vinyl sales have gone up. So I think that's really changed the game in so many different ways, and it's forced, for instance, independent artists who used to shun like licensing their songs for commercials or maybe movie soundtracks. That used to be a big no-no in the 90s and before, but you see lots of bands like Yola Tango or whoever licensing their music to commercials because that's one of the primary revenue streams that they can have access to nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Well, you heard in the first half hour that now it's the consumers who are in the driver's seat driving this and labels and artists having to react. Is that the way you see it as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Napster came about because there was a music fan who and computer programmer who wanted to figure out a way to share music with his friends and other people at his college, and then it snowballed into the thing that became known as Napster. So basically, Napster and everyday people who designed these sorts of programs like Napster and the file sharing networks that followed. You know, basically the record labels got dragged kicking and screaming into the online music business because they just before that refused. So it's definitely the consumers, regular people who are driving the business nowadays.
Sean Moeller, let me go to you, founder and owner of Daytrotter.com. And now I'm thinking it's been about 8 years that you've been around with Daytrotter.com. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So as I mentioned, it's a website for a recording studio based in Rock Island. You have sessions, all kinds of sessions, every day with popular upcoming indie music acts, enjoying great success. Can you give us an idea of what's happened to you, the growth that you've had in the last 8 years?
You know, I mean, basically for us, I mean, the growth has really been, You know, I think it's the same sort of thing that happens with bands. You know, if you stick around long enough and you're doing good stuff, you know, you like to think that it carries some sort of weight and kind of can propel you a little bit more. But, you know, for us, it's just really been, about just kind of doing quality work and you know, bringing in great bands and being able to showcase, you know, good music, good art. And, you know, that's what I founded the, you know, Day Trotter on is that sort of premise of, you know, how do we put people in the best possible light? I mean, I think it's, you know, goes without saying that, you know, you go see somebody play live and it could be anybody. It could be a regional musician who's never going to play outside of Cedar Rapids, or it could be, you know, the biggest band in the world. And you know, so many times you're struck by what you saw that night. And that was always sort of the intention. I think we've just been able to portray that in a way, and I think you know, I think artists have found us to be a very, very helpful thing to their careers.
Mm-hmm. So to describe a little bit more of the appeal, you're in the center of the country. Actually, you're at a crossroads where bands north, south, east, west, artists are crisscrossing the country, sometimes on wheels, often on wheels, and so it's just convenient for them. Is that part of it?
Yeah, you know, it's convenient, and you know, it still speaks to, you know, these are all artists and they want to be heard in the best possible light. And they want, you know, they're all gearheads and they all love recording. They all love the songs that they create and they love playing them for people. And we provide a platform where there are a lot of people listening to what we post. And we have great engineers and you know, we make them sound great, and you know, that still goes a long ways. You know,
that speaks to
the whole vinyl revolution, you know, coming back. You know, if something sounds great, you're going to gravitate to it, and we sort of have a history, and we've built it over time, and we're really proud of it that, you know, we make people sound good.
In fact, I think you have some sort of a vinyl series that's ending today, I saw on your website.
Yeah, we've started pressing limited edition vinyl runs of Day Trotter sessions, and those we make them available for between 2 weeks and a month, and then they're gone forever.
Mm-hmm. Kembrew McLeod, you mentioned vinyl before too. So what do you see as the allure of vinyl coming back? What's behind that trend, even though it is a very small part of the market?
Well, I mean, on one level, it's or in the most fundamental level, I think it's a kind of fetish object. You know, it's people really like holding that thing, and especially if it's a gatefold LP, even if it's not a double LP, you can still make a single LP that folds out, and you get to read the lyrics. The lyrics are bigger rather than on tiny CD. And it really, I think, you know, the resurgence of vinyl sort of really kind of reminds, it certainly reminded me that the CD is this kind of cheap plastic object that has very little like aura. Yeah.
Do you see that? We talked last half hour with Tom Carolyn, and he or with our record collector actually in Davenport, and thought, well, maybe CDs just need a little bit more time to have a little more nostalgia attached to them. But you think they're just cheap products that won't achieve the comeback that we're seeing with vinyl?
Well, yeah, I joked a couple years ago to friends that you know, I want to start the CD revival before the CDs completely die. You know, but basically the CD is just simply digital media. And if you're already listening to music in a digital medium, it's much more convenient to just simply download a high quality MP3. Or like MP3s are still limited in the sound quality; they don't sound as good as vinyl, but I'm talking about like I'm talking about, I don't want to get into kilobytes and stuff like that, but,
right.
but anyway, yeah, I think that the CD, it died in part because people had already embraced this and gotten used to, consuming music in this digital medium. And then when digital distribution came along, it's just simply more convenient. It's more portable to carry around, a phone or an iPod with a bunch of music than it is to carry around CDs.
Sean Moeller of daytrotter.com, do you have anything to do with CDs?
As little as I possibly can these days, yeah. I buy everything. You know, I get, like kind of anyone in the industry who sort of, gets promos and things like that. I mean, I get stacks and stacks of promos every day in the mail, and those all come on CDs. And, if there's something that I really love, I go out and I actually buy it. I'm never sort of content with a CD or having, the songs on my iPhone. That's just not how I like listening to stuff. And so, if I'm building my collection, I'm always getting the vinyl copy of it rather than a CD.
I think last time we talked, Sean, we talked about the fact that the bands you record there in Rock Island are recorded on quarter-inch tape, analog tape. Is that still the case?
That's still the case, yeah. Sometimes we're out on a day that somebody comes in and we're waiting for our shipment of tape, but for the most part, it still happens. Yep.
Do I have this right in my memory that there's really only one or two manufacturers of audio tape in the world?
There are only a few. Yeah. There's only a few that make new tape still, but they're making it a lot more these days.
Now, this is interesting because we just talk about vinyl, and then we talk about where we are now, the latest trend, the fact that more and more users, listeners, consumers are not buying anything physical. In fact, they're not buying individual songs or albums. They're listening to large libraries of music, Rhapsody, Spotify, or Pandora. But it coexists with the resurgence of the bulkiest music product, Cambrew, that you can imagine, the LP.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to, the reasons for the vinyl resurgence, I think Spotify, Rhapsody, all these services basically have pushed people, or at least a small segment of music lovers, back to, old school vinyl. There's something really satisfying about being able to have instant access to whatever song. That's great. I'll fess up to that. It also just, nevertheless, these services leave a kind of hollow, empty feeling in my stomach as a music lover.
Uh-huh. Sean Moeller, when someone goes, a band, an artist goes to daytrotter.com, your studios in Rock Island, is the setting also as retro as the recording technology?
I think even more so than people could possibly imagine. It's not the sharpest place in the world, but a lot of times those are the places that the best sounds come out of.
Mm-hmm. Kimber McLeod, you do a lot of work in intellectual property, and mm-hmm. that was mentioned in our first half hour too. Where does that come into this conversation in terms of where artists want to be and how they can make revenue streams, also the labels as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing we need to think about is we shouldn't be calling it the record industry. It's the music industry. And the record industry, or the CD record industry, for the most part, those revenues have shrunk dramatically over the past 10 years. Those revenue streams have been replaced a lot by licensing. As I was mentioning, for instance, licensing music to commercials, and so basically, what I'm saying is that even though like the record industry is shrinking, the overall health of the music industry is still fairly strong. I mean, especially because a lot of the revenues that are produced in the industry are song publishing revenues. And so, when a song is played on radio or on Pandora or whatever, it generates this income. So it's not, there's, I guess, this myth that the music industry is dying, and it really hasn't. And I think the way that the music industry can continue to thrive is to figure out ways to simplify licensing, because from personal experience, like licensing music for my last documentary, Copyright Criminals, that I did with Ben Franzen, it's a very complicated, unnecessarily complicated process where basically you're paying lots of lawyers and middle people a lot of money to work out these deals, and that money goes to, lines the lawyers' pockets and not the artists. And I think if we had a more simple way of figuring out a licensing system today for music, then more revenues would go to artists.
How does, Sean Moeller, how does licensing complicate your life, make it a challenge, or does it?
You know, for us, it's a bit of a different thing. You know, I mean, we're creating new masters, and you know, we're not sort of in that world really. So it doesn't really come into play.
Give us an idea of your business model. How does your revenue stream break down?
Well, basically, it's you know, I would say it's 90% based on the membership model that we set up. We started the site in 2006 with an advertising model, and it's just such a hustle. I mean, it never you know,
these are ads that people would see pop up.
Correct.
Or be part of the screen when you go to daytrotter.com, and that those ads don't bring in much.
Man, no, they don't. And you know, for the amount of work that we do and the amount of stuff that we have to pay for on a monthly basis, and you know, with growing interest and growing site traffic, you know, our costs just go up, and you know, we just weren't able to make it work. And about a year and a half ago, we decided to kind of you know, cross the fingers and hope that we were doing something that our listeners appreciated, and we went to a membership model where it's $2 a month to become a member of Daytrotter, and that's essentially our revenue model now.
Mm-hmm. And how many members do you have?
Well, you know, between free trial members and paying members, you know, we have between 30,000 and 40,000 people on the site a day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Founder and owner of Daytrotter.com joining us this half hour, Sean Moeller, also with us, Cambrew McLeod of the University of Iowa, also a documentary producer, has written and done a lot of things to do with popular music, independent media, copyright law. Finishing up our conversation, throwing another couple people who want to join in with their favorite albums of all time on vinyl. That's what we were asking. The Beatles' White Album is what Joel named a Facebook post from David. Moody Blues' album, Days of Future Past. Sean Moeller, what if I asked you that same question? Do you have a vinyl, excluding your own? Do you have a vinyl that if you go back to your early days, before you're 20, and I said vinyl album, favorite of all time, what would be your picture?
Oh, man. Man, I feel like I'm on the spot here.
Okay, we can go to Cambrew first.
Go to Cambrew. I'll think about it for a second.
He's noodling there.
Sean, yeah, you passed the buck. Okay, so let me just say they might be Giant's first album. I bought it based on the cover just because it looked really weird when I was in high school around 1986, 87, and I still have a romantic attachment to it. You know, it's a fetish object.
Okay, Sean Moeller, you have to step back in the batter's box, please.
Yeah, I think I have to go with Pet Sounds. I mean, not only is it one of my favorite records of all time, but kind of the whole petting zoo, feeding the goats, it's pretty great.
A tweet from Chris, who's listening: I love all the Iowa artists that are put out records on Maximum Ames Records, an all Iowa, all vinyl record label. Thanks for reminding of us of that in a tweet from Chris. Let's end with this. I wonder, you know, with all this new technology, different ways of enjoying music, of buying music, of streaming music, of accessing music, do we have a defining sound of music in this generation, as we have had in previous generations, 60s, 70s, 80s, and so forth, Cambrew?
Yeah, I think contemporary pop nowadays is defined by the kind of low-quality, compressed music that people are used to consuming and hearing on really bad speakers, on, you know, really bad, poorly encoded MP3s. And so what you hear in a lot of pop music is, like, especially dance pop music, is, yeah, the kind of artifacts of really bad-sounding audio that have basically been pushed to the forefront.
Okay, quickly from you, the same question. Sean.
I think people are just, I think, like you said, I mean, people are content with very low standards these days. And I think it really is, you know, I think as much as anything, you know, there is that fetish, you know, sort of nature to vinyl. And yet, I think more than anything, it is sort of a bit of a, a bit of a refusal to kind of just go the way of poor sounding recordings, because everybody knows, you know, for the most part, you know, if you're not talking sort of the DIY artists, you know, that where it's just so easy to record something and throw it up on the internet just to spit it out and get it out there, which, you know, there's something really beautiful about that as well in kind of a non-sonic quality. But I think a little bit of the vinyl thing is really kind of that refusal to settle for, you know, poor-sounding recordings.
Okay, Sean Moeller, we have to go, founder of Daytrotter.com in the Quad Cities, Kembrew McLeod of the University of Iowa. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
And we want to close out the show today. Here's Mumford & Sons and Friends, a track, Not Without With Haste, off the album Babel, one of the best songs of 2012, released by Daytrotter. Babel was also the number 3 vinyl album in the U.S. last year. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support today from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Let's listen to a little bit more of Mumford & Sons, courtesy of Daytrotter.
My love, my candle bright. Learn me hard, oh, learn me right. This ain't no sham. I am what I am. Though I may speak some tongue of old, or even spit out some holy word, I have no strength from which to speak.